In the rearview mirror, the sheriff's eyes appear, sharp and blue. "She's in for murder," he says, and none of us speak for the rest of the ride. When I applied to Yale Nursing School, Mama asked her pastor to say an extra prayer for me in the hope that God could sway the admissions committee if my transcript from college could not. I remember being mortified as I sat in church beside her, as the congregation lifted their spirits and their voices heavenward on my behalf. There were people dying of cancer, infertile couples hoping for a baby, war in third world countries. In other words, so many more important things the Lord had to do with his time. But Mama said I was equally important, at least to our congregation. I was their success story, the college graduate who was going on to make a difference. On the day before classes were supposed to start, Mama took me out to dinner. "You're destined to do small, great things," she told me, "just like Dr. King said." She was referring to one of her favorite quotes, "If I cannot do great things, I can do small things in a great way." "But," she continued, "don't forget where you came from." I didn't really understand what she meant. I was one of a dozen kids from our neighborhood who had gone to college, and only a handful of those were destined for graduate school. I knew she was proud of me. I knew she felt like her hard work to set me on a different path had paid off. Given that she'd been pushing me out of the nest since I was little, why would she want me to carry around the twigs that had built it? Couldn't I fly further without them? I took classes in anatomy and physiology and pharmacology and principles of nursing. But I planned my schedule so that I was always home for dinner to tell my mama about my day. It didn't matter that my commute to and from the city was 2 hours each way. I knew that if Mama hadn't spent 30 years scrubbing floors at Ms. Mina's house, I wouldn't be on that train at all. "Tell me everything," Mama would say, spooning whatever she'd cooked onto my plate. I passed along the remarkable things I'd learned. That half the population carries the MRSA germs in their nose. That nitroglycerin can cause you to have a bowel movement if it makes contact with your skin. That you are taller in the morning than the evening, by nearly a half inch, because of the fluid between your spinal discs. But there were things I didn't tell her, too. Though I may have been at one of the finest nursing schools in the country, that mattered only on campus. At Yale, other nursing students asked to see my meticulous notes or to have me join their study group. During clinical rotations at the hospital, teachers praised my expertise. But when the day was over, I'd walk into a convenience store to buy a Coke, and the owner would follow me around to make sure I didn't shoplift. I'd sit on the train as elderly white women walked by without making eye contact, even though there was an empty seat beside me. A month into my tenure at nursing school, I bought a Yale travel mug. My mother assumed it was because I had to leave before dawn in order to catch the train to New Haven every day, and she'd get up and make me a fresh cup of coffee each morning to fill it. But it wasn't caffeine I needed. It was a ticket into a different world. I would settle the mug on my lap every time I got on the train, with the word Yale purposefully turned so other passengers could read it as they boarded. It was a flag, a sign saying, "I'm one of you." The women's prison, it turns out, is a good hour's drive from New Haven. After we arrive, Liza and I are shuttled into a holding cell that looks exactly the same as the one I was in at the courthouse, only more crowded. There are 15 other women already inside. There are no seats, so I slide down a wall and sit on the floor between two women. One has her hands laced in front of her and is praying under her breath in Spanish. The other is biting her cuticles. Liza leans against the bars and begins to weave her long hair into a fishtail braid. "Excuse me," I say quietly. "Do you know if they'll let me make a phone call?" She glances up at me. "Oh, now you want to talk to me. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude. I'm new to all of this." She snaps a rubber band at the end of her braid. "Sure, you get a phone call. Right after they serve you your caviar and give you a nice massage." I am shocked by this. Isn't a phone call a basic right for prisoners? "That's not what it's like in the movies," I murmur. Liza places her hands under her breast and plumps them. Don't believe everything you see. A female guard opens the door to the cell. The praying woman gets up, her eyes full of hope, but the officer motions to Liza instead. Good God, Liza, you back again? Don't you know nothing about economics? It's all supply and demand. I ain't in this business by myself, officer. If there weren't such a demand for my services, the supply would just dry up. The guard laughs. Now there's an image, she says, and she takes Liza by the arm to lead her out. One by one, we are plucked from the cell. No one who leaves comes back. To distract myself, I start making lists of what I must remember to tell Adisa one day when I can look back on this and laugh. That the food we are given during our multi-hour wait is so unidentifiable that I can't tell if it's a vegetable or a meat. That the inmate who was mopping the floor when we were marched inside looked exactly like my second grade teacher. That although I am embarrassed by my nightgown, there is a woman in the holding cell with me who is wearing the kind of mascot costume you see at high school football games. Then finally, the same officer who took Liza away opens the door and calls my name. I smile at her, trying to be obedient as possible. I read her name tag. Gates. Officer Gates, I say, when we are out of earshot of the other women in the cell. I know you were just doing your job, but I'm actually being released on bail. The thing is, I need to get in touch with my son. Save it for your counselor, inmate. She takes another mugshot of me and rolls my fingerprints again. She fills out a form that asks everything from my name and address and my gender to my HIV status and substance abuse history. Then she leads me into a room slightly bigger than a closet that has nothing inside but a chair. Strip, she announces. Put your clothes on the chair. I stare at her. Strip, she repeats. She folds her arms and leans against the door. If the first freedom you lose in prison is privacy, the second is dignity. I turn my back and pull my nightgown over my head. I fold it up carefully and set it on the chair. I step out of my panties and fold them too. I put my slippers on top of the pile. As a nurse, you learn how to make a patient comfortable during moments that would otherwise be humiliating. How to drape the spread legs of a woman in labor, or draw a Johnny over a bare bottom. When a laboring mother defecates because of the pressure of the baby's head, you clean it up briskly and say it happens to everyone. You take any embarrassing situation and you do what you can to make it less so. As I stand shivering, naked, I wonder if this guard's job is the absolute opposite of mine, if she wants nothing more than to make me feel shame. I decide I'm not going to give her the satisfaction. Open your mouth, the officer says, and I stick out my tongue like I would at the doctor's office. Lean forward, show me what's behind your ears. I do as I'm told, although I can't imagine what anyone could hide behind her ears. I am instructed to flip my hair, and to spread my toes, and to lift up my feet so she can see the bottoms. Squat, the guard says, and cough 3 times. I imagine what a woman might be able to smuggle into jail, given the remarkable flexibility of the female anatomy. I think about how when I was a student nurse, I had to practice to figure out the width of a dilated cervix. 1 centimeter was an opening the size of a fingertip. 2.5 centimeters were the second and third fingers, slipped into an opening the size of the neck of a bottle of nail polish remover. 4 centimeters of dilation were those same fingers spread in the neck of a 40-ounce bottle of Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce. 5 centimeters was the opening of a 50-ounce Heinz ketchup bottle. 7 centimeters, a plastic shaker of Kraft Parmesan cheese. Spread the cheeks. A few times, I have helped deliver the baby of a survivor of sexual assault. It makes perfect sense that, during childbirth, memories of abuse might be triggered. A body in labor is a body in stress, and for a rape survivor, that can lead to a survival reflex that physiologically slows down or stops the progress. In these cases, it's even more important for the L&D room to be a safe space, for the woman to be listened to. For her to feel like she has a say in what happens to her. I may not have much say here, but I can still make the choice to not be a victim. The whole point of this examination is to make me feel lesser than, like an animal, to make me ashamed of my nakedness. But I have spent 20 years seeing how beautiful women are, not because of how they look, because of what their bodies can withstand. So I stand up and face the officer, daring her to look away from my smooth brown skin, the dark rings of my nipples, the swell of my belly, the thatch of hair between my legs. She hands me the orange scrubs that are designed to conform me, and the ID tag with my inmate number, meant to define me as part of a group instead of an individual. I stare at her until she meets my eye. "My name," I say, "is Ruth." Fifth grade, breakfast. My nose was buried in a book, and I was reading facts aloud. "There were twins who were born 87 days apart," I announced. Rachel sat across from me, picking at her cornflakes. "Then they weren't twins, stupid." "Mama!" I yelled automatically. "Rachel called me stupid!" I turned the page. "Sigurd the Mighty was killed by a dead man he beheaded. He tied the guy's head to his saddle and was scraped by a tooth and got an infection and died." My mother hurried into the kitchen. "Rachel, don't call your sister stupid, and Ruth, stop reading vile things while everyone's trying to eat." Reluctantly, I closed the book, but not before letting my eyes light on a final fact. There was a family in Kentucky that, for generations, had been born with blue skin. It was the result of inbreeding and genetics. "Cool," I thought, holding out the flat of my hand and turning it over. "Ruth," my mother said sharply, which was enough to let me know that it was not the first time she'd called my name. "Go change your shirt." "Why?" I asked, before I remembered I wasn't supposed to talk back. My mother yanked at my uniform blouse, which had a stain the size of a dime near my ribs. I scowled. "Mama, no one's even going to see it once I put my sweater on." "And if you take your sweater off?" she asked. "You don't go to school with a stain on your shirt, because if you do, people aren't going to judge you for being sloppy. They're going to judge you for being black." I knew better than to cross Mama when she got like this. So I took the book and ran to the room I shared with Rachel to find a clean white shirt. As I buttoned it, my gaze drifted towards the trivia book where it had fallen open on my bed. "The loneliest creature on earth is a whale that has spent more than 20 years calling out for a mate," I read, "but whose voice is so different from those of other whales that none of them ever respond." In the bedroll I am given are sheets, a blanket, shampoo, soap, toothpaste, and a toothbrush. I am entrusted to the custody of another inmate who tells me important things, that from now on all my personal hygiene items have to be purchased from the commissary, that if I want to watch Judge Judy in the rec room, I have to get there early for a good seat, that halal meals are the only edible ones, so I might want to say I'm Muslim, that someone named Wig gives the best tattoos because her ink is mixed with urine, which means it's more permanent. As we pass by the cells, I notice that two inmates occupy each one, and that the majority of the prisoners are black, and that the officers are not. There is a part of me that feels the way I used to when my mother made my sister take me out with her friends in our neighborhood. The girls would make fun of me for being an Oreo, black on the outside, white on the inside. I'd wind up getting very quiet out of fear I was going to make a fool of myself. What if a woman like that is my roommate? What could we possibly have in common? The fact that we're both in prison, for one. I turn the corner, and the inmate sweeps her arm in a grand gesture. "Home, sweet home," she announces. I peek inside to find a white woman sitting on a bunk. I put my bedroll on the empty mattress and begin to pull free the sheets and blanket. "Did I say you could sleep there?" the woman asks. I freeze. No. "You know what happened to my last roommate?" She has frizzy red hair and eyes that do not quite look out in the same direction. I shake my head. She comes closer until she is a breath away. "Neither does anyone else," she whispers. Then she bursts out laughing. "Sorry, I'm just messing with your head. My name's Wanda." My heart is beating in the back of my throat. "Ruth," I manage, I gesture to the empty mattress. So this is... Yeah, whatever. I don't give a shit as long as you stay out of my stuff. I jerk my head, agreeing, and make the bed as Wanda watches. You from around here?
East End.
I'm from Bantam. You ever been there? I shake my head. No one's ever been to Bantam. This your first time?
I glance up, confused.
In Bantam?
In prison.
Yes, but I won't be here for long. I'm waiting for my bail to clear.
Wanda laughs.
Okay, then.
Slowly I turn.
What?
I've been waiting for the same thing. Going on 3 weeks now.
3 weeks.
I feel my knees buckle, and I sink to the mattress.
3 weeks.
I tell myself my situation is not Wanda's, but all the same.
3 weeks.
So what are you in for? She asks.
Nothing.
It's amazing how nobody in here did anything illegal. Wanda lies back on her bunk, stretching her arms up over her head. They say I killed my husband. I say he ran into my knife. She looks at me. It was an accident, you know? Like the way he broke my arm and gave me a black eye and pushed me down the stairs. And those were accidents, too.
There are stones in her voice. I wonder if, in time, mine will sound that way, too.
I think of Kennedy telling me to keep to myself.
I think of Turk Bauer, and picture the tattoo I saw in the courtroom, blazing across his shaved scalp. I wonder if he has spent time in prison. If this means we, too, have something in common.
Then I picture his baby, curled in my arms in the morgue, cold and blue as granite.
I don't believe in accidents, I say, and I leave it at that.
The counselor, Officer Ramirez, is a man with a face as round and soft as a donut, who is slurping his soup. He keeps spilling on his shirt, and I try not to look every time it happens. Ruth Jefferson, he says, reading my file. You had a question about visitation?
Yes, I reply.
My son, Edison, I need to get in touch with him so that he knows how to get together the papers we need for bail. He's only 17.
Ramirez rummages in his desk. He takes out a magazine, guns and ammo, and a stack of flyers about depression, and then hands me a form.
Write down the name and address of the people you want on the visitor list.
And then what?
Then I mail it out, and when they sign it and send it back, the form gets approved and you're good to go.
But that could take weeks.
About 10 days, usually, Ramirez says.
Slurp. Tears flood into my eyes.
This is like a nightmare. The kind where someone shakes your shoulder as you are telling yourself this is a dream and says, this isn't a dream.
I can't leave him alone that long.
I can contact Child Protective Services.
No, I blurt out. Don't.
Something makes him put down his spoon and look at me. Not unkindly.
There's always the warden.
He can grant you a courtesy visit for 2 adult visitors before the official application is processed. But given that your son is 17, he'd have to come in the company of another adult.
Adisa, I think. And then immediately, I remember why she'll never be approved by the warden for a visit. She has a record, thanks to a forged rent check 5 years back.
I push the form back across the desk to him. The walls feel like the shutter of a camera closing.
Thank you anyway, I manage, and walk back to my cell.
Wanda is sitting on her bunk, nibbling on a Twix bar. She takes one look at me, then breaks off a tiny piece and offers it. I take it in my hand and close my fist around it. The chocolate starts to melt.
No phone call?
Wanda asks, and I shake my head. I sit on my bunk, and then turn away from her so that I am facing the wall.
It's time for Judge Judy, she says. You want to watch?
When I don't respond, I hear Wanda pad out of our cell, presumably toward the rec room. I lick the candy from my hand and then press my palms together and talk to the only slice of hope I have left.
God, I pray, please, please be listening.
When I was little, I used to have sleepovers with Christina at her brownstone. We would unroll our sleeping bags in the living room, and Sam Hollowell would run a movie projector with old cartoons that he must have gotten when he was a television executive. This was, back then, a big deal. There were no VCRs or video on demand. A private screening was a treat reserved for movie stars. And, I guess, their children. Although I was skittish about being away from home for the night, this was the next best thing. Mama would run a bath for us and get me into my pajamas and make a treat of hot cocoa and cookies before she left. And by the time we woke up, she was already back and making us pancakes. Whatever differences there were between Christina and me grew more indelible as we got older. It was harder to pretend that it didn't matter my mama worked for hers, or that I had to work after school while she became a striker for the soccer team, or that the clothes I wore on casual Fridays used to belong to Christina. It wasn't that she was unfriendly to me. The barricade was built with my own suspicions, one brick of embarrassment at a time. Christina's friends were all blonde, pretty, athletic, fanning around her like the matching spokes of a snowflake. If I didn't hang around their edges, I told myself, it was because I didn't want Christina to feel like she had to include me. The real reason I distanced myself, though, was because it hurt less to step away than to risk the inevitable moment where I would become an afterthought. The only problem with disassociating myself from Christina was that I didn't have many other friends. There was a Pakistani exchange student and a girl with cataracts that I tutored in math, but what we had in common was the fact that we didn't really fit in anywhere else. There was a cluster of other black kids, but their upbringing was still a world away from mine, with their parents who were stockbrokers and fencing lessons and summer cottages on Nantucket. There was Rachel, who was 18 now and pregnant with her first child. She probably needed a friend, but even when we were face-to-face across the kitchen table, I couldn't think of a single thing to say to her, because the things she wanted out of her life were so different from what I hoped for in my own. And because, honestly, I was a little scared that if I started hanging around with her, all the stereotypes she'd wrapped herself in would rub off like shoe polish and make it even harder to fit in seamlessly in the halls of Dalton. So maybe that's why, when Christina invited me to a slumber party she was having one Friday, I said yes before I could remember to stop myself. I said yes, and hoped that she would prove me gloriously wrong. In the company of all these new friends of hers, I wanted to share our inside jokes about the time Christina and I made helmets out of tinfoil and hid in the dumbwaiter pretending it was a spaceship to the moon. Or when Ms. Mina's dog, Fergus, pooped on her bed and we used white paint to cover the stain, certain no one would ever notice. I wanted to be the only one who knew which kitchen cabinet held the snacks and where the extra bedding was kept and the names of each of Christina's old stuffed animals. I wanted everyone else to know that Christina and I had been friends even longer than they had. Christina had invited two other sophomores, Misty, who claimed to be dyslexic to get accommodations on homework, but who seemed to have no trouble reading aloud from the stack of Cosmo magazines that Christina had brought onto the roof deck, and Kiera, who was obsessed with Rob Lowe and her own thigh gap. We had all stretched out towels on the teak deck. Christina turned up the radio as a Dire Straits song came on and started singing all the lyrics by heart. I thought of how we used to play Ms. Mina's records, all original Broadway cast recordings, and dance around pretending to be Cinderella or Ava Perón or Maria von Trapp. From my bag, I pulled out a bottle of sunscreen. The other girls had rubbed themselves with baby oil as if they were steaks on a grill, but the last thing I wanted to be was darker. I noticed Kiera looking at me.
"Can you tan?"
Yeah, I said, but I was spared going into detail by Misty interrupting.
"This is so awesome," she said. "The British invasion." She twisted the magazine so that we could look at the models, each one twiggier than the last, draped in next season's clothes with Union Jacks and gold-button red coats that made me think of Michael Jackson.
Christina sank down beside me, pointing.
"Linda Evangelista is, like, perfect."
"Ugh, really? She looks like a Nazi."
"Cindy Crawford is so natural," Kiera countered.
I peered at the photographs.
My sister's going to London this summer, Kira added, backpacking through Europe. I made my dad promise in writing that when I was 18, I could go too.
Backpacking? Misty shuddered. Why?
Because it's romantic, duh. Just think about it. Uriel passes, hostels, meeting hot guys.
I think the Savoy's pretty romantic too, Misty said. And they have showers.
Kira rolled her eyes. Back me up, Ruth. No one in a romance novel ever meets in the lobby of the Savoy. They bump into each other on a train platform or accidentally pick up each other's backpacks, right?
Sounds like fate, I said. But what I was thinking was that there was no way I couldn't work for a summer. Not if I planned to go to college.
Christina flopped onto her belly on the towel.
I'm starving. We need snacks.
She looked up at me.
Ruth, could you go get us something to eat?
Mama smiled when I came into the kitchen, which smelled like heaven. A rack of cookies was cooling, another sheet was just going into the oven. She held out the mixing spoon and let me lick the dough.
How are things up in Saint-Tropez?
Everyone's hungry, I told her. Christina wants food.
Oh, she does she? Then how come she isn't the one standing in my kitchen asking?
I opened my mouth to reply, but couldn't find the answer. Why had she asked me? Why had I gone? My mama's mouth drew tight.
Why are you here, baby?
I looked down between my bare feet. I told you, we're hungry. Ruth, she repeated, why are you here? This time I couldn't pretend to misunderstand.
Because, I said so quietly that I could barely hear it. So quietly I was hoping my mother couldn't either.
I don't have anywhere else to go.
That is not true, she insisted. When you're ready for us, we'll be waiting on you.
I grabbed a plate and began to stack cookies on it. I didn't know what my mother meant, and I didn't really want to know. I avoided her the rest of the afternoon, and when she left for the night, we were already locked inside Christina's bedroom, playing Depeche Mode and dancing on the mattress. I listened to the other girls confess their secret crushes, and pretended to have one myself so that I could be part of the conversation. When Kiara brought out a flask filled with vodka, it has the least calories, you know, if you want to get drunk. I acted like it was no big deal, even though my heart was racing. I didn't drink because Mama would have killed me, and because I knew I had to stay in control. Every night before bedtime, I lotioned my skin and rubbed cocoa butter into my knees and heels and elbows to keep them from being ashy. I brushed my hair around my head to encourage growth and wrapped it in a scarf. Mama did this, and so did Rachel, but I was pretty sure those rituals would be foreign to anyone at this sleepover, even Christina. I didn't want to answer questions or stick out any more than I already did, so my plan was to be the last girl in the bathroom and to stay there until everyone had fallen asleep, and then to wake up before dawn and fix my hair before anyone else was stirring. So I stayed awake as Misty recounted in painstaking detail what it was like to give a blowjob, and Kiara got sick in the bathroom. I let everyone brush their teeth before me and waited long enough to hear snoring before I emerged in the pitch dark. We were sleeping wedged like sardines, four of us in Christina's queen-size bed. I lifted the covers and slipped in beside Christina, smelling the familiar peach shampoo she had used forever. I thought she was asleep, but she rolled over and looked at me. My scarf was wrapped around my head, red as a wound, the ends trailing down my back. I saw Christina's eyes flicker to it, and then back to mine. She did not mention the wrap.
I'm glad you're here, Christina whispered.
And for a brief blessed moment, so was I. Late that night, as Wanda's snore whistles through the bunk, I lie awake. Every half hour, a CO comes by with a flashlight, making sure that everyone's asleep. When he does, I close my eyes, pretending. I wonder if it gets easier to sleep with the sounds of 100 women around you. I wonder if it gets easier, period. During one of those circuits, the flashlight bounces with the CO's footsteps, and then stops at our cell. Immediately, Wanda sits, scowls.
Get up, the CO says. What the hell? Wanda challenges. Now you're tossing cells at midnight? You ever hear of prisoners' rights? Not you. The officer jerks his head toward me. Her.
At that, Wanda holds up her hands, backing off. She may have been willing to share a Twix with me, but now I am on my own. My knees shake as I stand and walk to the open cell door.
Where are you taking me?
The CO doesn't respond, just steers me down the catwalk. He stops at a doorway, buzzes the control desk, and there is a grating buzz as a lock is released. We step into an airlock and wait for the door to close behind us before the next door magically opens. In silence, he leads me to a small room that looks like a closet. He hands me a paper grocery bag. I peek inside to see my nightgown and my slippers. I yank the scrubs off my body, starting to fold them out of habit, and then leave them in a pile on the floor. I pull on my old clothes, my old life. The CO is waiting when I open the door again. This time, he takes me past the cell where I was kept waiting when I first arrived, which has only two women in it now, both curled on the floor asleep and reeking of alcohol and vomit. Then suddenly we are outside, crossing a fence with a necklace of barbed wire. I turn to him, panicking. I don't have any money, I say. I know we are an hour or so away from New Haven, and I don't have bus fare or a phone or even proper clothing. The CO jerks his head in the distance, and that's when I notice that the dark is moving, a shadow against a moonless night. The silhouette morphs until I see the outline of a car, and the person inside who gets out and starts running toward me. Mama, Edison says, his face buried in my neck. Let's go home.
Kennedy. There are two types of people who become public defenders. Those who believe they can save the world, and those who know damn well they can't. The former are starry-eyed law school grads convinced they can make a difference. The latter are those of us who have worked in the system and know the problems are so much bigger than we are or the clients we represent. Once a bleeding heart calluses into realism, victories become individual ones. Being able to reunite a mom who's gone through rehab with her kid who was put in foster care. Winning a motion to suppress evidence of a former addiction that might color the odds for a current client. Being able to juggle hundreds of cases and triage those that need more than a meet-em and plead-em. As it turns out, public defenders are less Superman and more Sisyphus. And there's no small number of lawyers who wind up crushed under the weight of the infinite caseloads and the crappy hours and the shitty pay. To this end, we learn quickly that if we're going to keep a tiny bit of our lives sacrosanct, we don't bring our work home with us. Which is why, when I dream of Ruth Jefferson for two consecutive nights, I know I'm in trouble. In the first dream, Ruth and I are having an attorney-client meeting. I ask her the standard set of questions I'd ask of any client. But every time she speaks, it is in a language I don't understand. It's not even a language I recognize. Embarrassed, I have to keep asking her to repeat herself. Finally, she opens her mouth, and a flock of blue butterflies pours out. The second night, I dream that Ruth has invited me over to dinner. It is the most sumptuous table, with enough food for a football team, and each dish is more delicious than the last. I drink one glass of water, and then another, and a third, and the pitcher is empty. I ask if I can get a refill, and Ruth looks horrified. I thought you knew, she says. And when I glance up, I realize that we are locked inside a prison cell. I wake up, dying of thirst. Rolling onto my side, I reach for the glass of water I keep on my nightstand and take a long, cool drink. I feel Micah's arm slide around my waist and pull me against him. He kisses my neck. His hand slides up my pajama shirt. What would you do if I went to prison? I blurt out. Micah's eyes open. I'm pretty sure since you're my wife and over 18, this is legal. No. I roll to face him. What if I did something and got convicted? That's kind of hot. Micah grins. Lawyer in prison. Okay, I'll play. What did you do? Say public indecency. Please say public indecency. He pulls me flush against him.
Seriously, what would happen to Violet? How would you explain it to her?
Kay, is this your way of telling me that you actually finally did kill your boss?
It's a hypothetical.
In that case, could we revisit the question in about 15 minutes? His eyes darken, and he kisses me. While Micah shaves, I try to pin my hair into a bun. Going to court today? He asks. His face is still flushed, so is mine.
This afternoon. How did you know?
You don't stick needles into your head unless you're going to court.
They're bobby pins, and that's because I'm trying to look professional, I say.
You're too sexy to look professional.
I laugh. Let's hope my clients don't feel the same way. I spear a flyaway hair into submission and lean my hip against the sink. I'm thinking of asking Harry to give me a felony.
Great idea, Micah says with mild sarcasm. I mean, since you already have 500 open cases, you should definitely take on one that requires even more time and energy.
It's true. Being a public defender means I have nearly 10 times as many cases as are recommended by the ABA, and that on average, I have less than an hour to prepare each case that goes to trial. Most of the time I am working, I do not eat lunch or take a bathroom break. If it makes you feel any better, he probably won't give it to me. Micah clatters his razor against the porcelain. When we were first married, I used to stare at the tiny hairs that dried in the bowl of the sink with wonder, thinking that I might read in them our future the way a psychic would read tea leaves.
Does this sudden ambition have anything to do with the question about you going to prison?
Maybe, I admit.
Well, I'd much rather you take his case than join him behind bars.
Her, I correct. It's Ruth Jefferson, that nurse. I just can't shake her story. Even when a client has done something unlawful, I can find sympathy. I can acknowledge a bad choice was made, but still believe in justice, as long as everyone has equal access to the system, which is exactly why I do what I do. But with Ruth, there's something that doesn't quite add up.
Suddenly, Violet comes charging into the bathroom. Micah tightens the towel around his waist, and I tie my robe.
Mommy, Daddy, she says. Today I match Minnie.
She clutches a stuffed Minnie Mouse. And indeed, she has managed to pull on a polka-dotted shirt, yellow sneakers, a red bikini top, and long white tea gloves from the dress-up bin. I look at her, wondering how I am going to explain that she can't wear a bikini to school.
Minnie's a fallen woman, Micah points out. I mean, it's been 70 years. Mickey ought to put a ring on it.
What's a fallen woman? Violet asks.
I kiss Micah. I'm going to kill you, I say pleasantly.
Ah, he replies. So that's why you're going to prison.
At the office, we have a television, a tiny screen that sits between the coffee machine and the can opener. It's a professional necessity because of the press coverage our clients sometimes get. But in the mornings, before court is even in session, it's usually tuned to Good Morning America. Ed has an obsession with Lara Spencer's wardrobe, and to me, George Stephanopoulos is the perfect balance of hard-hitting reporter and eye candy. We sit through a round of hypothetical polls pitting presidential candidates against one another, while Howard makes a fresh pot of coffee, and Ed recounts dinner with his in-laws. His mother-in-law still calls him by the name of his wife's ex, even though they've been married for 9 years.
So this time, Ed says, she asked me how much toilet paper I use.
What did you tell her?
Just enough, Ed replies.
Why did she even want to know?
She said they're trying to cut back, Ed answered, that they're on a fixed income. Mind you, they go to Foxwoods 3 out of 4 weekends a month. But now we're rationing the Charmin?
Well, that's crap, I say, grinning. See what I did there? Robin Roberts is interviewing a portly, middle-aged redhead whose poem was accepted for a highly literary anthology, but only after he submitted it with a Japanese pseudonym.
It was rejected 35 times, the man says, so I thought maybe I'd be noticed more if my name was more...
colorful? Roberts supplies. Ed snorts.
Slow news day.
Behind me, Howard drops a spoon. It clatters into the sink.
Why is this even a thing?
Ed asks. Because it's a lie, I say. He's a white insurance adjuster who's co-opted someone else's culture so he could get 15 minutes of fame.
If that were all it took, wouldn't hundreds of poems by Japanese poets get published every year? Clearly what he wrote was good. How come no one's talking about that?
Harry Blatt, my boss, blusters through the break room, his coat a tornado around his legs.
I hate rain, he announces. Why didn't I move to Arizona?
With that greeting, he grabs a cup of coffee and holds himself up in his office. I follow him, knocking softly on the closed door. Harry is still hanging up his drenched coat when I enter.
What?
He asks. You remember that case I arraigned, Ruth Jefferson?
Prostitution?
No, she's the nurse from Mercy West Haven. Can I take it? He settles behind his desk.
Right, the dead baby.
When he doesn't say anything else, I stumble to fill the void. I've been practicing for 5 years almost, and I feel really connected to this one. I'd like the opportunity to try it.
It's a murder,
Harry says. I know. But I really, really think I'm the right public defender for this case, I say. And you're going to have to give me a felony sooner or later, I smile. So I'm suggesting sooner. Harry grunts, which is better than a no.
Well, it would be good to have another go-to lawyer for the big cases. But since you're a rookie, I'll have Ed second chair it with you.
I'd rather have a Neanderthal sitting at the table with me. Oh, wait. I can do it myself, I tell Harry. It isn't until he finally nods that I realize I've been holding my breath. I count the hours and the arraignments I have to slog through before I am free to drive to the women's prison. As I sit in traffic, I run over opening conversations in my mind that will allow Ruth to have confidence in me as her attorney. I may not have tried a murder before, but I've done dozens of drug and assault and domestic jury trials. This isn't my first rodeo, I say out loud to the rearview mirror, and then roll my eyes. It's an honor to represent you. Nope, sounds like a publicist meeting Meryl Streep. I take a deep breath. Hello, I try. I'm Kennedy. 10 minutes later, I park, shrug on a mantle of false confidence and stride into the building. A CO with a belly that makes him look 10 months pregnant sizes me up.
Visiting hours are over, he says.
I'm here to see my client, Ruth Jefferson. The officer scans his computer.
Well, you're out of luck.
I beg your pardon?
She was released 2 days ago, he says.
My cheeks flame. I can only imagine how stupid I look, losing track of my own client. Yes, of course. I pretend that I knew this all along, that I was only testing him. I can still hear him snickering as the door of the prison closes behind me. A couple of days after I sent a formal letter to Ruth's house, the address of which I have from the bail posting, she comes to the office. I am headed to the copy machine when the door opens and she walks in, nervous and hesitant, as if this cannot possibly be the right place. With the bare bones and the stacks of boxes and paper, we look more like a company that is either setting up shop or closing its doors than a functional legal office. Ruth, hello. I hold out my hand. Kennedy McQuarrie, I say. I remember... She is taller than I am, and stands with remarkable posture. I think, absently, that my mother would be impressed. You got my letter, I say, the obvious. I'm glad you're here because we've got a lot to talk about. I look around, wondering where I am going to put her. My cubicle is barely big enough for me. The break room is too informal. There's Harry's office, but he's in it. Ed is using the one client meeting room we have to take a deposition. Would you like to grab a bite? There's a Panera around the corner. Do you eat... food? She finishes. Yes. I pay for her soup and salad and pick a booth in the back. We talk about the rain and how we needed it and when the weather might turn. Please, I say, gesturing to her food. Go ahead. I pick up my sandwich and take a bite just as Ruth bows her head and says, Lord, we thank you for our food, furnishing our bodies for Christ's sake. My mouth is still full as I say amen. So you're a churchgoer, I add after I swallow. Ruth looks up at me. Is that a problem? Not at all. In fact, it's good to know because it's something that can help a jury like you. For the first time, I really look at Ruth carefully. The last time I saw her, after all, her hair was wrapped and she was wearing a nightgown. Now she is dressed conservatively in a striped blouse and navy skirt, with shiny patent flats that are rubbed raw in one small spot each at the heels. Her hair is straight, pulled into a knot at the base of her neck. Her skin is lighter than I remember, almost the same color as the coffee milk that my mother used to let me drink when I was little. Nerves manifest differently in different people. Me, I get talkative. Micah gets pensive. My mother gets snobbish. And Ruth apparently gets stiff, which is something else I file away. Because jurors who see that can misinterpret it as anger or haughtiness. I know it's hard, I say, lowering my voice for privacy. But I need you to be 100% honest with me. Even though I'm a stranger, I mean, hopefully I won't be one for long. But it's important to realize that nothing you say to me can be used against you. It's completely client-privileged. Ruth puts her fork down carefully and nods. All right. I take a small notebook out of my purse. Well, first, do you prefer the term black or African American or people of color? Ruth stares at me. People of color, she says after a moment. I write this down, underline it. I just want you to feel comfortable. Frankly, I don't even see color. I mean, the only race that matters is the human one, right? Her lips press together tightly. I clear my throat, breaking the knot of silence. Remind me again where you went to school? SUNY Plattsburgh, and then Yale Nursing School. Impressive, I murmur, scribbling this down. Ms. McQuarrie, she says. Kennedy. Kennedy. I can't go back to prison. Ruth looks into my eyes, and for a moment, I can see right down into the heart of her. I've got my boy, and there's no one else who can raise him to be the man I know he's going to be. I know. Listen, I'm going to do my best. I have a lot of experience in cases with people like you. That mask freezes her features again. People... like me? People accused of serious crimes, I explain. But I didn't do anything. I believe you. However, we still have to convince a jury. So we have to go back to the basics to figure out why you've been charged.
I think that's pretty obvious, Ruth says quietly. That baby's father didn't want me near his son.
The white supremacist? He has nothing to do with your case.
Ruth blinks. I don't understand how that's possible.
He isn't the one who indicted you. None of that matters. She looks at me as if I'm crazy.
But I'm the only nurse of color on the birthing pavilion.
To the state, it doesn't matter if you're black or white or blue or green. To them... you had a legal duty to take care of an infant under your charge.
Just because your boss said don't touch the baby doesn't mean you get a free pass to stand there and do nothing. I leaned forward. The state doesn't even have to specify what the degree of murder is. They can argue multiple theories, contradictory theories. It's like shooting fish in a bucket. If they hit any of them, you're in trouble. If the state can show implied malice because you were so mad at being taken off the baby's case and suggest that you premeditated the death, the jury can convict you of murder. Even if we told the jury it was an accident, you'd be admitting to a breach in duty of care and criminal negligence with reckless and wanton disregard for the safety of the baby. You'd basically be giving them negligent homicide on a silver platter. In either of those scenarios, you're going to prison. And in either of those scenarios, it doesn't matter what color your skin is. She draws in her breath. Do you really believe that if I was white, I'd be sitting here with you right now? There is no way you can look at a case that has, at its core, a nurse who is the only employee of color in the department, a white supremacist father, and a knee-jerk decision by a hospital administrator, and not assume that race played a factor. But any public defender who tells you justice is blind is telling you a big fat lie. Watch the news coverage of trials that have racial overtones, and what will stick out profoundly is the way attorneys and judges and juries go out of their way to say this isn't about race, even though it clearly is. Any public defender will also tell you that even though the majority of our clients are people of color, you can't play the race card during a trial. That's because it's sure suicide in a courtroom to bring up race. You don't know what your jury is thinking, or can't be certain of what your judge believes. In fact, the easiest way to lose a case that has a racially motivated incident at its core is to actually call it what it is. Instead, you find something else for the jury to hang their hat on. Some shred of evidence that can clear your client of blame and allow those 12 men and women to go home still pretending that the world we live in is an equal one. No, I admit. I believe it's too risky to bring up in court. I lean forward. I'm not saying you weren't discriminated against, Ruth. I'm saying that this is not the time or place to address it. Then when is? She asks, her voice hot. If no one ever talks about race in court, how is anything ever supposed to change? I don't have the answer to that. The wheels of systemic justice are slow, but fortunately there's a little more oil in the machinery for personal justice, which throws cash at the victims to remove some of the indignity. You file a civil lawsuit. I can't do it for you, but I can call around and find you someone who works with employment discrimination. But I can't afford a lawyer. They'll take your case on contingency. They'll get a third of whatever payout you win. I explain. To be honest, with that post-it note, I think you'd be able to get compensatory damages for the salary you lost, as well as punitive damages for the idiotic decision your employer made. Her jaw drops. You mean I'd get money? I wouldn't be surprised if it was a couple million, I admit. Ruth Jefferson is speechless. You've got 180 days to file an EEOC complaint. And then what? Then the EEOC will sit on it until the criminal trial is finished. Why? Because assigning a guilty verdict against a plaintiff is significant, I say frankly. It will change how your civil lawyer will draw up the complaint for you. A guilty finding is admissible as evidence and would hurt your civil case. She turns this over in her mind. Which is why you don't want to talk about discrimination during this trial, Ruth says. So that guilty verdict won't come to pass. She folds her hands in her lap, silent. She shakes her head once, and then closes her eyes. You were kept from doing your job, I say softly. Don't keep me from doing mine. Ruth takes a deep breath, opens her eyes, and meets my gaze. All right, she says. What do you want to know?
Ruth. The morning after I am released from jail, I wake up and stare at the same old crack in the ceiling that I always say I'll patch and never get around to doing. I feel the bar from the pullout couch digging into my back and give thanks for it. I close my eyes and listen to the sweet harmony of the garbage trucks on our street. In my nightgown, a fresh one, I will donate the one I wore to the arraignment to Goodwill at the first opportunity. I start a pot of coffee and pad down the hall to Edison's bedroom. My boy rests like the dead. Even when I turn the knob and slip inside and sit down on the edge of the mattress, he doesn't stir. When Edison was little, my husband and I would watch him sleep. Sometimes Wesley would put his hand on Edison's back, and we'd measure the rise and fall of his lungs. The science of creating another human is remarkable, and no matter how many times I've learned about cells and mitosis and neural tubes and all the rest that goes into forming a baby, I can't help but think there's a dash of miracle involved, too. Edison rumbles deep in his chest and rubs his eyes. "Mama," he says, sitting up instantly awake. "What's wrong?" "Nothing," I tell him. "Everything is right in the world." He exhales, then looks at his clock. "I have to get ready for school." I know from our conversation in the car last night on the drive home that Edison missed a whole day of classes in order to post bail for me, learning more about mortgages and real estate than I probably know myself. I'll call the school secretary to explain about yesterday. But we both know there's a difference between "please excuse Edison for being absent, he had a stomach bug," and "please excuse Edison for being absent, he was bailing his mother out of jail." Edison shakes his head. "That's okay. I'll just talk to my teachers." He doesn't meet my eye, and I feel a seismic shift between us. "Thank you," I say quietly. "Again." "You don't have to thank me, Mama," he murmurs. "No, I do." I realize to my shock that all the tears I managed to keep inside during the last 24 hours are suddenly swimming in my eyes. "Hey," Edison says, and he reaches out to hug me. "I'm sorry," I say, hiccuping against his shoulder. "I don't know why I'm falling apart now. It's gonna be okay." I feel it again. That movement of the earth beneath my feet. The resettling of my bones against the backdrop of my soul. It takes me a second to realize that for the first time in our lives, Edison is the one comforting me instead of the other way around. I used to wonder if a mother could see the shift when her child became an adult. I wondered if it was clinical, like the onset of puberty, or emotional, like the first time his heart was broken, or temporal, like the moment he said, "I do." I used to wonder if maybe it was a critical mass of life experiences, graduation, first job, first baby, that tipped the balance. If it was the sort of thing you noticed immediately when you saw it, like a port wine stain of sudden gravitas, or if it crept up slowly, like age in a mirror. Now I know. Adulthood is a line drawn in the sand. At some point, your child will be standing on the other side. I thought he'd wander. I thought the line might shift. I never expected that something I did would be the thing that pushed him over it. It takes me a long time to figure out what to wear to the public defender's office. For 25 years, I've dressed in scrubs. My nice clothing is reserved for church. But somehow a floral dress with a lace collar and kitten heels don't seem right for a business meeting. In the back of my closet, I find a navy skirt I wore to parent-teacher night at Edison School, and pair it with a striped blouse my mama bought me for Christmas from Talbot's that still has the tags on. I rummage past my collection of Dansko clogs, the saviors of nurses everywhere, and find a pair of flats that are a little worse for the wear, but that match. When I arrive at the address on the letterhead, I'm sure I've got the wrong place. There's no one at the front desk. In fact, there isn't a front desk. There are cubicles and towers of boxes that form a maze, as if the employees are mice, and this is all part of some grand scientific test. I take a few steps inside, and suddenly hear my name. "Ruth, hello! Kennedy McQuarrie!" As if I could possibly have forgotten her. I nod and shake her hand because she is holding out her own. I don't really understand why she is my lawyer. She told me flat out at the arraignment that wouldn't be the case.